Welcome to PM Lessons Learned, a podcast for project managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Increase your PM knowledge, build business relationships, increase your effectiveness, increase your marketability, gain professional support. Join our group and take part in our conference calls. Details at pmlessonslearned.com.
Hello, and welcome to the PM Lessons Learned Best Practices Conference Call and Podcast. This is podcast number 133. We're recording the session on the 15th of March, 2012. My name is Dana Safford. I'm normally the host for the PM Lessons Learned Monthly PMP Exam Study Group Conference Call and Podcast. Our regular host, Henry Will, is off at the moment. He'll be here momentarily, perhaps. So I'm sitting in. Our topic for this session is Ignorance is Risk, presented by Bill Duncan. Before we get started, I'd like to let you all know that we are also in desperate need for volunteers. So for an announcement, I'd like to make sure folks are aware we were looking for volunteers. We recently established a volunteer cafe link on our website at www.pmlessonslearned.com. The volunteer cafe contains a list of opportunities, the role descriptions, the benefits to volunteering. There's also a link to let us know that you want to volunteer. So if you're able to give back to the project management community, please use that link and give us a hand. We're all unpaid volunteers at pmlessonslearned.com, all giving back to the community. Okay, our topic for this session is Ignorance is Risk, presented by Bill Duncan. When managing or working on a project, what you don't know can indeed hurt you. In this presentation, we'll cover seven common misconceptions about the project management field, ranging from truth about variances and change requests, both of which should be shot out and celebrated, by the way, to the reality of Brooks' Law, meaning that adding resources to a late project will not always make that project finish any later. Right? So if you haven't downloaded a copy of this session, please do so. If you're in the live free screen sharing conference room that we're in right now, the file is in the lobby. And to find out how to download this file and podcasts of all the other PM Lessons Learned sessions, go to www.pmlessonslearned.com. And in the left-hand navigation column, you'll see a link for files and presentations. The file for this presentation is in the Best Practices Call area. The file name is PMLL Ignorance is Risk-22-Color, and it's a PDF file. And that's what you're looking for. So look for that file name, and you should be all set. In there, you'll also see the links for a whole lot of other presentations as well. Our presenter for this session is Bill Duncan. Bill is a top trainer and owner of PM Partners in Massachusetts. He's also the Director of Certification for the American Society for the Advancement of Project Management and the Global Alliance for Project Performance Standards, or GAPS. Bill is an IPMAB assessor for the International Project Management Association as well. That means if you want to achieve B-level certification, that's a senior project management level, for those of you who are not aware, Bill is the guy you have to get through. So he's a good guy to know. Finally, Bill is the primary author of the very first version of the PMBOK Guide that was released in 1996. He is recognized as one of the world's leading experts on theory and practice of project management. His training programs are learner-centered to ensure the development of useful skills. His consulting practice emphasizes doable recommendations for real benefits. Okay, so we are PMLessonsLearned.com, project managers helping project managers to make a difference. I'll thank you in advance, those who are participating in the live conference call and those who download the podcast. I'll say welcome to Bill, and please take it away.
All right, great. Thanks, Dana. This may sound a little bit weird, but I'm actually going to start with a bit of an apology slash explanation. The original design of this program was for an hour and 15-minute session that I was doing for the Project Summit meeting, and when I sent the abstract off to Dana and Henry, I forgot that that 40 to 45 minutes was more what they were looking for here, but we had already publicized seven items, and I didn't really feel that it was appropriate to cut it out. So what I did is I dropped a slide or two, I've eliminated the animation, and my plan at this point is to go through the slides fairly quickly. If you've counted them up, there's 42, and if we're looking for about 40 to 45 minutes, that says about 1 minute per slide. Now, there are a couple of slides where I clearly won't need even a minute, but there are several, obviously, where I will need more. So I'm going to ask you to hold your questions until the end. If you would make a note of the slide number that your question refers to when you have it, That'll help us go back, and I'll put that slide up when we get to the question session. So jumping right in, just a quick review of what we're looking at with project risk management. If you look at the first line there, I would argue that what project risk management is about is helping the project's decision makers, project manager, sponsor, clients, owners, et cetera, make good choices. And of course, good choices require good information. So if we are missing information, look at here two types of ignorance. If we're missing information or if we have misinformation, that's going to cause us problems on the project. We will likely end up making bad decisions. Now, in this presentation this evening, I'm going to focus on the aspects of misinformation, on things that you may have been told by someone that you may have been led to believe are true, and in fact, they're not. I've characterized these as fictions. Here's the list of seven fictions for reference. I'm going to jump right into it. Each one has a subtitle slide, so we'll take a look at each of these items in series. Fiction number one, many of you have probably heard this, been told this. When you're planning a project, they say you should try and limit your project activities to 24 hours worth of effort. Now, I'm going to go back a bit on the next slide, on slide six here. When I got started in project management, and this may give you some indication of how old I am, we had the 80-hour rule. Mm-hmm. And I was told when I first started that no activity should ever take more than 80 hours. Now, if you look at the assumptions that underlie that statement, first of all, for the most part, this concept was really only applied on large projects, and typically team members were, in fact, assigned full-time. Almost everybody on these projects was assigned full-time, and they were working on only one project at a time. So 80 hours of effort typically meant that it was about 2 weeks of elapsed time. The individual would be assigned to work on a task or an activity, and they would be expected to devote their full energy to that item until it was done. And in addition, status was typically reported monthly. So if you look at the rationale here, basically what we're saying is the 80 hours means that no activity is ever going to spread past more than one reporting period. If you started in March and it's not finished by the end of March, it will always be finished by the end of April. So if we look next at how this 80 turned into 24 over the space of about 20 years, there were a couple of factors. First, reporting went from monthly to weekly. Pretty much everybody now, I think, reports status weekly. Sometimes on large contracts, you may only have a requirement to deliver detail to the client monthly, but typically you're tracking your own performance weekly. Somehow the units got switched from duration to effort. When people were talking about 80 hours of effort, they were really talking about 2 weeks of duration. And then, of course, as I'm sure you're all aware, most staffing, particularly on smaller projects, went from full-time to part-time. So the 80 hours first became 40 and then eventually became 24. But in fact, if you look at the real drivers behind the rule, what we're really saying is the reason we want to have a limit on the size of the activity is for reporting, so that we don't allow things to go too far without knowing that it's done. So the guideline here is really that the duration of the average activity should be equal to the reporting period. If you're reporting weekly, you want your average activity to be a week long. That way it'll never go more than one reporting period. You should never have an activity that's more than twice the reporting period. If it goes along too long, then it's possible for it to get out of control before you really know about it. And what we want to focus on is effort as just a consideration, not actually a constraint. So it's not really 24 hours worth of effort. The guideline should be what you're seeing up here on the top two. Those are the rationale behind what was originally the 80-hour rule, now the 24-hour rule. So truth number one, well, you should be focusing on average activity duration, not maximum effort. Moving into fiction number two, lots of you probably, if you looked at your project life cycles, will see planning listed as a phase, and that's just not appropriate. Let me try and explain why. I'm going to start with a concept of scope versus work. I've got a definition here for you. Scope being the characteristics of the product of the project. This is what the PMBOK guide originally called product scope, and work is what you have to do to actually deliver that product. And the PMBOK guide originally called this project scope. But product scope and project scope kind of confused a lot of people. Over the years, I've simplified my language. Scope versus work is an important concept, understanding that there's a difference. To illustrate the difference, if somebody asked you to paint the room that I'm sitting in here, and they said, I'd like you to paint it red, and then I changed my mind and said, no, don't paint it red, paint it blue, the question becomes, is that a scope change? When I ask this question in my training programs, I get some people will raise their hand and argue absolutely yes. Other people will raise their hand and argue absolutely no. But if you look at the definition, when I change the characteristics from a room painted red to a room painted blue, I have clearly changed the scope. I have changed the characteristics of the thing that I'm going to deliver to my client. The second question is, has the work changed? And the answer there is the correct answer to every question in project management. Specifically, it depends. Now, depends upon when the work has, or when that scope change comes in, whether it impacts the work. If the color has changed before I've done any painting, if the blue paint has the same coverage characteristics as the red paint, then it may in fact not affect the work at all. You can very easily see that if I've painted half the room already, there's a substantial impact on the work. So we have a situation where the same change to scope can have a different effect on the work based upon when it happens, when it's noticed, when it's reported. In terms of the project lifecycle, what this tells us is that we've got two different kinds of things that are involved. The project lifecycle is intended to address the scope-oriented processes. On this chart, I've listed a traditional waterfall-style diagram running from left to right. One thing that I'd like to focus on the waterfall here is the arrows going back up showing feedback. There should, in fact, be feedback and iteration throughout a waterfall design or a waterfall project lifecycle. As you get down to development, you may discover design errors. You may discover that you've either missed or misunderstood requirements, so you need to cycle back up in order to repeat the activities of that phase. The activities within that phase to make sure you have everything right. If you're involved in software development and you're doing using agile techniques for your project, then in that case, the iterations are exact analogs for the phases of a waterfall model. We want to check in with the client at the end of each phase, say, does it make sense to continue with this project? And the guidance that we get from our project lifecycle model tells us how we're going to go about developing the product characteristics, figuring out what it is we actually have to produce. Our project management methodologies here on slide 13 are defining the work-oriented processes. Now, many of you may look at this particular diagram as somewhat familiar. It's a little bit like the diagram of the process groups within the PMBOK guide. But I've changed a couple of names, and I've drawn the plan, control, and accomplish in the middle as clouds to emphasize the fact that these things overlap, interact, and are actually a little bit fuzzy. The approval process, the closeout process, should be reasonably clean, but the stuff in the middle is not. So you see planning here as part of the project management methodology, but if we move on to the next slide, what's important to remember is that these process groups repeat within each phase of the project. So when you're planning, if you have planning as a phase of the project, it's not telling you what you're planning. It's not giving you the guidance that you need to address both scope and work, which leads us to tooth number two. If you want to be effective, you've got to have a product-oriented project lifecycle. Moving along to item number three. Many of you have probably been told this, that your job is to minimize change. Now, let's take a look at change. We've got two different kinds of changes, which is why I've used the two-faced Janus god from Greek mythology. And if you look at these two columns here, you probably understand that bad changes are the ones that occur late in the project. Something that comes in at the last minute is always going to be a problem. But good changes are things that happen early in the project. I find out early enough to adjust, modify my approach. We don't like bad changes because they cause schedule slips, cost overruns, and, of course, constant replanning. But if we find out about the changes early enough in the process, we get better outcomes. The benefits from the project that we're working on are typically increased, and as a result of that, we also have happier clients. So the truth is, second piece is you need to understand the difference between scope change and scope creep. My little cartoon character here on the upper right is intended to be a scope creep. I guess that's a lousy joke. But looking at the definitions, scope change is something that's gone through an approved process. It's been reviewed, understood, accepted. And the key aspect of scope change is that we do, in fact, modify our performance measurement baselines. If we have additional scope, that will normally mean additional cost. May not always mean additional time, but it may require additional time in order to deliver the scope. There's nothing wrong with changes as long as the baselines are, in fact, modified. Scope creep comes in when we get changes that are accepted without going through the proper control process. Now, these changes can be actual changes to scope, or they can simply be changes to understanding of what we wanted to have done or what the client wanted. But even if it's a change to an understanding, still needs to go through the change control process. Still need to make sure that we modify the baselines so that the information that we're reporting, the information that we're monitoring against, is in fact accurate and useful for our client. So this now leads to truth number three, which is that your job as a project manager is not to avoid change or minimize change, but simply manage it. Change is good when it's handled in the right way. Fiction number four, lots of people complain about the problem with developing good estimates, particularly when we're working on a project dealing with something that we haven't done before. But there's a couple of problems with that. First of all, I think a lot of people don't understand that there are two kinds of estimates. I think a lot of organizations don't understand that there are two kinds of estimates. I've just listed the highest level and the lowest level here. Funding estimate, which is a preliminary prediction. Estimates are always predictions. And the idea behind a funding estimate is to help management decide whether or not they want to do this project. So you come up with a great idea, you present it to management, you say this is going to cost about $1 million, and management says yes or no. Doesn't mean that $1 million should be the final delivery budget. Basically, what management is saying is looking at the benefits, looking at the business case. If this project is going to cost around $1 million, it's a good investment. We should, in fact, do it. We are eventually going to want to get to a working estimate, which will be more detailed, more reliable. This is the prediction that we're going to use to establish our controls for both cost and schedule, things that we will monitor the performance of the project against. It's entirely possible, after the project is approved and as we move through the project life cycle, that we will discover that this project is going to be substantially more expensive than we thought it was going to be. Nothing wrong with that. We just need to communicate that information to the decision makers, explain how this came about. Was it a surprise, something we didn't realize? Was it, in fact, a scope change from somewhere? That we needed to include additional scope in order to attain the benefits. What's the reason? They may approve it. They may cancel the project. Entirely their decision. There are cases when moving ahead with the project with the current scope is a complete waste of resources. So we need to first understand the two different kinds of estimates. Second thing we need to understand, and I'm going to use the example of driving to the airport or driving to work if you prefer, is we need to understand how to develop an estimate. I live in Lexington, Mass., which is outside of Boston, and if I'm going to Logan Airport and I decide to go at 2 o'clock in the morning, I can pretty much guarantee you that it's going to take me 30 minutes to get from the door of my house to Terminal A at Logan Airport. Now, if I leave at 8 o'clock in the morning, that's a little bit different situation. There is still uncertainty within the drive, so I need to know what my assumptions are. But I can nonetheless estimate my drive time based upon my experience having done this before. Now, if I have never driven to the airport before, clearly there will be more difficulty developing an estimate. I may need to gather some information, do a little bit of research. Maybe I want to drive once. Maybe I want to go out to Google Maps and see how long it is, and I will make an estimate of the how much time it will take to drive based upon the distance. So there are a variety of things that I can do, but they're all driven by a couple of ideas. The first one we talked about on the last slide, which is the idea that estimates are predictions. They're not guarantees. So what we want to do is we want to always have estimates that are expressed as ranges. Some of you will be familiar with this kind of a chart, talking about optimistic, most likely, and pessimistic, typically brought up in the context of PERT, but you don't have to be using the old-time technique of PERT to use range estimates on your individual projects. Basically, what we're saying here is we're trying to identify the range of possible outcomes. We're not developing three estimates. We're developing a single estimate that is described in terms of 3 points based upon a particular set of assumptions. So if I'm leaving my house to go to Logan Airport and I'm leaving at 8 o'clock in the morning, my range is going to be, might still take 35 minutes, could get lucky even on a commuter day, but it's more likely to take closer to 60, and I need to recognize that it may take as much as an hour and a half to 2 hours on the pessimistic end. Once I have the range estimates, I can do some nice things with them statistically. I'm not going to go into the details of this chart. This is a very simple project, 2 deliverables, 7 activities. I've estimated in staff hours the amount of effort that will be required for each of these activities. And then I've done some statistical calculations over on the right. First one I'll call your attention to is the expected value. I'm assuming a triangular distribution, so the expected value is the arithmetic average of the 3 points. And then I'm also using an approximation for calculating the variance in the second column there. And what I want to use the variance for from the individual activities is to calculate the standard deviation for the project. So if you look down at the bottom row of this chart, I want to call your attention to three primary numbers. The first is 290. That's the sum of the expected values. The second number is 20. That's the standard deviation for the project. And the third number is 250. That's the sum of the most likely results. Now, looking at this chart on page 25, slide 25, what this is illustrating is that if I were to go to my boss and ask for a budget of 290 hours on this project, that's the sum of the expected values, I would have a 50% probability of success. You can see that 50% written on the arrow down below. 290, the sum of the expected values, is the midpoint of the project's distribution. If I were able to run this project in a simulation, it would be over 290 hours half the time, and it would be under 290 hours the other half the time. Actually, technically, it would be exactly 290 a couple of times, but we'll ignore that for the time being. If I add 20 hours to it, so that I take the 290 and put it up to 310 hours, I now have an 84% probability of success. Plus one standard deviation adds an additional 34% of the possibilities. So if I were to run a simulation on this project, I would find that 84% of the time, approximately, I'm under budget. Now, here's a thought for you. If you think about the game of Russian roulette, basically, Russian roulette, you have an 84% probability of success. 5 chambers are empty, 1 chamber is full. Spin the barrel, point the gun at your head, and pull the trigger. 5 times out of 6, you should expect to survive. So at the 310-hour budget on this project, we're basically playing Russian roulette with our career. We've got one bullet in the gun. We're going to spin the barrel, point it at our career, choose your head or your foot, up to you, pull the trigger and see what happens. If we had asked our boss for a budget of 290 hours, we now have a 50% probability of success, which means we've got 3 bullets in the gun. If you remember the last number that I asked you to remember, that's 250. That was the sum of the most likelies. In this particular case, that has only a 3% probability of success. If you had taken the most likely estimates, which is probably what you would get from your people if you're doing single-point estimating, and you add them up, you most frequently end up with a project that has very little chance of success the day that it begins. In this particular case, it's got about a 3% probability of success, two standard deviations below the mean. In Russian roulette terms, that means I've got 5 bullets in the gun. I actually have 6 bullets in the gun, but from one of the bullets, I've taken a little bit of powder out of it, and I'm hoping that if it happens to land on that chamber, that the bullet will misfire. And I'm basically, once again, playing Russian roulette with my career. So, truth number 4, if you understand about range estimates, good estimates really are pretty easy to develop. It takes a lot of the threat out of it. If we understand two different types, we understand how to deal with uncertainty. Fiction number 5, critical path analysis is reliable. Everybody probably tells you you should calculate the critical path on your project and figure out what's going on. Well, let's take a look at a couple of things. Slide 28 shows a very simple project. We've got 6 activities. We've got a couple of paths, 4 paths in total through the network. Probably isn't too hard for you to figure out that B and F, 30 days in duration, is the critical path on this particular project. But in fact, critical path is a very simplistic analysis in this case. Technically, this is called an activity-based critical path. And I am assuming a whole bunch of things, that resources are available, that the duration estimates are accurate and correct, and the dependencies have been defined correctly and accurately as well. Easy to calculate the critical path here, but if I look up at the top of this chart, for activities A and B, they're 29 days of duration, just 1 day left. So there's only a day float on those 2 activities. So while critical path tells us that BF is what we should be looking at with 30 days duration, in fact, AD is 29 days of duration, and it's very possible that either A or D is significantly delayed, could be what causes the project to be finished late or requires you to spend lots of time fixing it. You probably know most of that already. But here's a variation on that theme. What if activity D is not certain, but actually it might take 10 days or it might take 14 days? And we figure there's a 70% probability that it will take 10 and a 30% probability that it will take 14. Well, if it takes 10, clearly BF is still the critical path. But if it takes 14, and we're not saying it's late, this is because of different circumstances. If you think of a construction project, for example, the 14 days might be because we ran into bedrock or we ran into different site conditions than we expected. On a software project, it might be that your test bed is not ready on time, or maybe there are more errors detected than you expected, so it ends up taking a lot longer. Kind of difficult to figure out what the critical path is in that situation. Finally, most projects, there's actually a fair amount of uncertainty in the duration estimates. So if we look at basically the same network logic, but we look at the ranges of outcomes for the durations, now it becomes extremely difficult to figure out what the critical path is. I'm just going to throw one other thing at you. This is a little case study that I use in one of my training programs. You're asked to add 3 towers to King Louis Castle. And you can see the network logic diagram here with a small tower, a medium tower, and a large tower. The reason for the color coding of the design and build is that in this case, you have a resource constraint. You only have 1 designer and 1 builder. So that if I do the basic critical path analysis, this tells me that designing and building the small tower is the critical path. In this case, we're dealing with weeks of duration, so it says that the small tower is going to take 13 weeks. But in fact, if you want to get this project done as quickly as possible, that critical path analysis is pretty much useless. You actually have to do some analysis and think it through. In this particular case, what you want to do is design the large tower first, because that allows you to get the builder started as quickly as possible. Most of the time, most of the software products, in fact, do not deal very well with resource constraints. So the critical path calculation that you get or the critical path duration may, in fact, be wrong. Tooth number five, the critical path that you get out of most project management software has at best about an 80% chance of success. And that's assuming that you have some amount of schedule contingency in there as well. If you are operating with zero schedule contingency, critical path is probably closer to about a 65, maybe 70% probability of success. And that, again, is assuming that the resources will be available when and as planned, that all of the durations have been estimated, budgeted accurately, and so on. Fiction number six, one of my favorites. Variances are bad. People hate variances. I once saw a project plan. This was part of a legal case that I was asked to provide testimony in. The contractor had almost 50 pages of activities, with I think about 15 or 20 activities per page, that showed zero variance. They had budgeted 40 hours for the activity. They spent 40. They budgeted 80 hours for the activity. They spent 80. Zero variance for page after page after page. On the very last page, there was one little task called unplanned work. And unplanned work had over 4,000 hours of effort charged to it. I think you can pretty quickly guess what was going on here. Anytime an activity ran over, instead of recognizing that the activity was taking longer than expected, they said, oh, this overage was unplanned, therefore we're going to bury it all here in the unplanned work bucket. I think variances are good, and I've listed a couple of things here that I think having variances tell you. First one is very important. If you're seeing variances on your status report, it means that the team trusts you. Also means that they are, in fact, reporting their results accurately. They're not lying, cheating, fudging the numbers, whatever term you want to use. It also most likely means that they are, in fact, doing what they were asked to do. They are, in fact, completing the activity as it was specified, as you expect it to be done. They're not cutting corners in order to create a good report so that they won't look bad. What that means to you as the project manager is you do then actually know what's going on in your project, and as a result of that, you're in a better position to be able to take corrective action. So I'll repeat my earlier comment. I think variances are good, and I think when you see variances, you should have a little celebration. It means things are going well on the project. You've got accurate information. Even if it's not going well in the sense of being over budget or behind schedule, at least it's accurate, so you can take good corrective action. Fiction number seven, many of you are probably aware of, is Brooks' Law. It's stated as adding resources to a project makes it later. Now, I've got a much longer presentation on what I call project dynamics, which talks about how various elements of a project interact over time. This is just one piece of the overall model. I want to call your attention to the oval down on the bottom left that says pressure. Basically, the way the model works is when pressure is created because there is schedule variance or cost variance on the project, one of the things that we can do is add resources. So what the model shows is if you follow that dotted red arrow up to the time defined valve, that there's going to be a delay. It's going to take us some time before we are actually able to get a new resource assigned to the project. And that assignment goes from the resource pool box on the left to the rookies bucket, this term I should use, to the rookies bucket on the right. Now, if you look at the line that comes down off of the link from time defined to rookies, you'll see it's labeled search effort. So if I am trying to get additional resources assigned to my project, somebody on the project, typically the project manager, perhaps someone else, is going to be going out looking for those resources and negotiating for them, perhaps preparing justification statements. So that whole search effort increases the amount of work that we have to do. Adding resources to the project isn't free. Now let's take a look at the rookies budget. You look at the dotted line up there. As soon as the rookies come on board, as soon as your new team members arrive, they are typically charging to actual cost. They may not actually be producing anything. If we look to the right of the rookies bucket, you'll see another valve or gauge that's labeled up to speed. So we need to teach the rookies about what's going on in the project to date, about what's going on, what our team norms are, all the rest of this stuff. And if you look at the arrow that comes down that's labeled training effort, here again is additional work that has to be done. So let's look at what happens here. This little chart here on slide 38 shows in the first line some loss of time in requesting the new resource. Then on the second line, it shows training, and it's showing that somebody on your project is devoting the first case around 30 hours, going effectively down to 10, to the person getting them up to speed. So their contribution to the project, they start to contribute in the sixth week. But if you look at the very lowest level, the very lowest row there, the cumulative effect basically says if it's 4 weeks to get a new person assigned to the project, and if it takes them 6 weeks to be fully up to speed, it's actually 10 weeks before they are providing any positive contribution to the project. Before that, their contribution is all negative. They are, in fact, slowing the project down rather than speeding it up. And it may be, in many cases, it may be many more weeks than 10, but for a lot of white-collar projects, software, new product development, electronics, engineering design, this 4 weeks to find a resource and 6 weeks up to speed seems to be a pretty good average. So it's basically saying if you add somebody to your project on the 1st of April, it is probably going to be the middle of June before they're actually contributing in a positive way to the project. So this is where the idea that adding resources to a project, to a late project, makes it later. Well, not quite the whole truth. First statement here is a correct statement. Adding resources late to a late project makes it later. Somehow, many people have taken the statement that adding resources to a late project makes it later to imply that if they don't add resources, somehow they're going to come in on time. Nope, sorry. If you don't add resources to a project that's late, it's going to stay just as late as it was. It may continue to get a little bit later unless the slippage is extremely small in the sense of a couple of days. Avoiding adding resources to the project really isn't going to help you. Now, the secret, the truth here, if you will, is that adding resources is a good idea as long as you do it early enough. What I find a lot of project managers doing is because they've been told that adding resources makes the project later, is that they will resist the idea of adding resources to the project because they think it's going to make things worse. But in fact, if those resources are added to the project soon enough, they may actually allow you to deliver the full scope of your project on time. So here's a recap of the seven truths. I won't read all of them. You can read them, but just for easy reference for you. And Dana, I think that means we're now time for questions.
Oops, I should come off and mute myself. I think I shut off mute mode, so I think I've unmuted everybody's phone. And
okay.
Are there any questions out there from anybody? Okay, let me get started with a few questions of my own. You mentioned on slide 12, iterations are more or less like sprints in an Agile project. Are there anything else you would change to any of these seven rules that you've come up with right now that would also impact an Agile project besides this?
Not really. I think this is the issue with the life cycle. In some ways, an Agile project is forced to look at being driven by scope. What are the characteristics that you want to deliver at the end of an iteration or a sprint? And I think the steps in the old waterfall model repeat within each iteration. So, you know, you're looking at requirements for the story. You're doing design or use cases and then development, and, you know, turnover is the testing. So the basic steps that you go through are the same. You're just going through them for smaller pieces of the expected functionality. And if you're doing it right. You are delivering useful working software at the end of each iteration.
So the follow-on, would that be all these things will still be applicable to an Agile project as well? Just
Go formally back to the list. I'll run through the list first in terms of, actually, let's come down to the back of the project and look at the truths instead. I think you still want to be looking at the guidelines for activity duration on a sprint. If you are reporting to your client weekly, then you certainly don't want any activity that's going to take too much more than a week. If you are having daily meetings with the client, then I would argue that most of the activities that you're assigning and tracking should be about a day's duration, and probably shouldn't be anything that's more than two, or I might stretch it out to 3 days at that point. But in general, I'd say yes. Product-oriented, I think iterations are by nature product-oriented. Your job as project manager is still to manage change. You're probably looking at the high-level outline in terms of managing change if you're doing agile development. So you'll be looking at what features are going to be in the next iteration or sprint. Is there new stuff that's come up that needs to bump something out of the schedule? But same process, making sure that everybody understands and agrees to the impact. You still want to estimate how long it's going to take you to develop anything within a sprint. The range estimates are still powerful. You're probably not looking at critical path, but if you do any sort of critical path analysis on a sprint, you're probably going to be a little bit disappointed in the results. It's probably going to take longer than what critical path analysis tells you. I still think variances are good. It means people are being honest. And the question of adding resources, I think, is a little bit different, perhaps, because the idea is that the client always has the option of stopping after any individual sprint or iteration. So the question of adding resources would be driven by the expected total duration of the project. But even then, I think if you got sub-teams working in parallel so that you were delivering more with each iteration, you would probably find that to be a more effective approach for delivering the full scope than waiting until the client is frustrated because they don't have everything they want at the end of the project.
Yeah, they can always play with the story some a little bit there, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Another question I had was on slide 26.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bell curve that you had there. And
yep.
You mentioned going out one standard deviation would get you up to 83%. Is it a good practice to maybe add yet another standard deviation, get it up to 90 and up upwards of 97%?
Yeah, 97. Well, let me tell you a quick story there. I'll try and tell a short version. I was doing this with an Intact team. We were actually planning a real project. And the expected value, the midpoint that's 290 on this chart, was $1 million even, just about on that project. The standard deviation was about $50,000. The project manager said, I think I'm going to ask for a budget of $1,050,000. And one of her team members asked the exact question that you did. Well, why not just go for $1.1 million and have a 97% chance? Her response to that was, my boss is already expecting an estimate of around $1 million, so $1,050,000 isn't going to raise any alarms. $1.1 million might, just because it's now significant digits.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, so in that case, there was a political consideration. Now, you might also get into questions of, you know, what the boss noticed, $1,095,000 when they would. So there's still a little bit of an it depends there. The other issue is one of my clients basically maintains all of their contingencies at the program level. So the individual projects in that case would be budgeted for 290 hours. And if this particular project is unlucky and needs additional hours, the additional hours would come from the program level budget rather than from the project level budget. But at the same time, the project managers in that environment, if they're able to deliver the project for 250 hours, if they should happen to get lucky, they are expected to deliver the full scope for 250 hours and not spend 290. so that that 40 hours can be returned to the project, to the program, rather, to help make up for overruns on other projects.
Always a good thing to do. Yep. Give back when you can.
Yep.
Okay. Any other questions for anybody? Bart, George, and there's a few bunch of folks out there whose numbers I see in my conference call controls, but I don't know who the names are.
So, yeah, this is Bart. I have a question. First of all, keep your little joke about the scope creep, because
I
chuckled.
Well, you see, I came from an era when the typical programmer, when the stereotypical programmer, I should say, was somebody wearing white socks and sandals that hadn't showered in 3 weeks and had hair down to their waist. So that was always my image of the scope creep. But that particular chart was the closest I could come.
It works.
But I particularly, I was particularly interested in that last one about adding the extra resources when the project's late. It kind of tells me that what I should do is, if it's getting late, pay attention early and then kind of make that kind of chart that you had, reflecting where we're at, and figure out, okay, where can we at the latest start adding resources, and kind of have that in front of me day by day to make sure that if we're getting later and we're getting too close that we can't do something with adding resources, then that's the time to do it and sell it to management.
I think one of the things that typically happens is that everybody is tight, and you come in and you ask for, you know, four bodies or six bodies or eight bodies or whatever the right number is for your project, and management kind of instinctively assumes that you're asking for more than you really need. They give you fewer and say, if you run into trouble, come back and try and deal with it. Well, of course you run into trouble because you don't have enough bodies to make the schedule. So then when you come back, you're faced with climbing the learning curve for the new guys. You're putting extra effort into convincing management that you really do need the people now. And it's kind of penny-wise and pound foolish. In general, it can be very difficult to convince management that what they should do is staff the project appropriately at the beginning. And then if you are fortunate enough to be under budget, is to let people go. Fundamentally, most managers don't believe us as project managers that we would actually release a resource if we didn't need them anymore. A lot of project managers have spent so much of their life being behind schedule that they're still absolutely fearful that even when they're sure that everything's going well, that something's going to come up and bite them. So once again, there are some political issues that are involved in how you manage and implement this. But the fundamental thing to understand is that if you wait too long to take corrective action, that's when Brooks's Law kicks in. If you try and add people at the last minute, it's just not going to help. It's going to make your problems worse.
Yeah. So I find it good to realize that from your presentation, but I also think that if I had to sell that I need these extra resources now and not next week if we're still behind, kind of thing, if I brought a chart in like that, it would help me get my point across of next week's going to be too late or whatever.
Well, be a little bit careful of your language too. You said if I had extra resources. It's not a question extra resources. It's a question of having enough resources.
Yes.
So you're not saying to management, give me extra, give me more than I really need. You're saying, give me what I need, and it should actually allow us to hit our date. It should actually cost less to deliver this project if you give me that one extra person now rather than making me wait 2 months and come back and re-justify it all over again. It does require you to establish some credibility with management about your ability to estimate accurately, about your ability to deliver. So there are several steps in here. It's not just as easy to show and management a chart.
Interesting.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Okay, great.
Any other questions, Bart? Or anybody else? No. Well, let me try this. We sometimes think with the PMI's flat view of the world that PMP certification is the only project management certification out there. Bill, I know you're pretty passionate about some of the other things out there, specifically part of American Society for the Advancement of Project Management and the IPMA certification scheme. Could you take a couple minutes and just give us a short version of that view of the world and see if any questions come up from that even?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. IPMA has, and we implement it here in the U.S. through ASAPM, which is the IPMA member association in the U.S. We have a performance-based certification that actually evaluates your actual work on the project. It requires you to provide evidence of your experience, not just in the form of a resume or someone saying, yes, you did this, but we're looking at documentation. We are interviewing the candidate. So, for example, last week I interviewed a guy for looking for Level C, which is the project manager certification. He had about a 2.5-hour test to go through that included both multiple choice and open answer essay questions. And then there was a 2-hour interview that in many ways is similar to a job interview. Tell me how you dealt with your stakeholders on your project. Tell me how you planned it. Tell me how you dealt with problems and issues. Tell me what you did to improve the project during the project. How did you provide feedback? How did you deal with problems and so on? So we have a bunch of specific criteria that we're looking for evidence for. Certainly it's a little more complex. I think it seems to be of more interest to companies that are looking to have several project managers assessed rather than individuals who are looking to have something to help them get a job. It's well recognized within Europe, much of Asia, Australia and China in particular. Not so well known at present in the U.S., but we're hoping to change that. I think it's a much more reliable evaluation of what an individual can do. And anybody's interested in more details, drop me an email.
And your email address is what that you'd like to see?
Well, actually, both on the first slide and the last slide. We've got your bookended there.
Beautiful. Fantastic. So thank you for that. The world is indeed round, and we need to make sure that folks are aware of that. All right, then, let me do a couple of housekeeping things, and then we'll be done for this session. I'll again thank Bill for taking the time to give back to the community. It's always great to have well-known practitioners or even unknown practitioners do this type of thing so that folks can understand what's going on. I'll again remind folks that in the beginning of this session, we are looking for volunteers here at PM Lessons Learned. So go to our website, www.pmlessonslearned.com, check out the Volunteer Cafe, and see if there's anything you can do to also give back to the project management community. And then I'll also remind you that PM Lessons Learned conducts 3 conference calls each month. On the first Thursday of the month, I host the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP exam study group call. On the second Thursday of each month, we have our PM Lessons Learned job shadow call, where folks in transition or with a need to identify potential career paths can go to help each other out. And finally, like we are on this session, the third Thursday of each month, we hold a PM Lessons Learned best practices call. And this call provides presentations on a wide variety of project management and soft topic skills, just like what you just heard just now. And that's where we are right now. So that's it for this session of the PM Lessons Learned best practices call. I'll again thank the presenter, Bill Duncan, for all his time and effort doing this. I'll also thank the live participants in this conference call and everyone that downloads the podcast. I'll remind you that we are PMLessonsLearned.com, project managers helping project managers to make a difference. For Henry Will, my name is Dana Safford. So long and keep on learning.
This has been a PM Lessons Learned podcast. Project managers helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Come join our group. Visit our website at pmlessonslearned.com. Till next time, keep on learning.